this evening, and I know the weather's very bad, and people have made considerable effort at some risk, I think, to come and be here tonight, and so we want to express appreciation for that. One of my great fears is at the end of a delightful and a very encouraging and enjoyable week that I will fail to express appreciation as I should. I'm not always good at this, and I tend to leave things out that I mean to say. But you will understand that and overlook that. As I say to you, I'm grateful for every expression of your appreciation and your encouragement throughout this week. And I couldn't have asked for anything better than that. I want to thank all of you who prepared your meals and did it with such loving care and did it with such a culinary skill that I have to say, someone says, "How are you feeling?" And I said, "Well, after a week of overeating and undersleeping, here I am." I have enjoyed the week, and especially the delightful experiences of being able to eat with you. To me, a meal is more than just a physical exercise. It has social implications, but even beyond that, it has spiritual implications. And when we can laugh and cry and share things at tables, that's a wonderful experience, and I appreciate it so much. It's an honor to be invited into people's homes, and I really sincerely desire to act in such a way as never to show a lack of appreciation for that. I want to thank you for all that time and effort, and it just does my heart good to be able to share in the services here with you. The men that have led the singing have done an excellent job. Those who've worded the prayers, even the brother tonight. And I appreciate that prayer, and it's stirring to me, and it's uplifting. And all the things we've shared together this week, and especially I focus on the time that I've been with Carol and Mamie. And it's been a hard week for both of them. Well, first of all, just me being there. You know, that takes care. I say that this is just a truism. After about 4 days, both fish and guests begin to stink. I mean, just put it plainly. I mean, you know, you can put up with that a little bit, but after a while, you know. But in addition to that, I know that Carol has been just had, he's had to get himself prepared for something that's coming up. And when you have that which faces you, it's sort of like Damocles' sword hanging over your head, you know. You just can't really rest easy anytime. But he's been a delight to be with. And there's a passage in Proverbs 27 that says, "As iron sharpeneth iron, so does a man sharpen the countenance of his friend." And that means that minds rubbed together can sharpen one another. And I've been sharpened by being able to share his thinking, his penetrating ideas and discussions. And he's so unusually gifted and capable in areas. And then the debates that he's had. And he's had some unique debates, unusual debates with unusual people that are very demanding to prepare for them. And I love the attitude in which he doesn't want to leave any stone unturned to be prepared to do that very thing. And that's so important. And I remember a young preacher asked me one time, he says, "Does it get any easier as you get older?" And I said, "No, if you do it right. You have to keep at it. You keep everlastingly at it and do your very best. And the older you get, you should know that you have to put that extra effort in preparation." And I've enjoyed the week. This particular theme, this topic, is demanding. It's demanding of the speaker. I'll just tell you that. It's one of the more difficult things I do, but it's demanding of listeners too, and I definitely understand that. The time that's involved in it and then the themes that we're thinking at, it puts special demands upon you, and I just appreciate your participation. We were able to go to the high school today, and we talked in two different sessions to three biology classes, and that was enjoyable. And I think that from the attitude manifested by the teachers and by the students, that it was a profitable time. And I appreciated the opportunity. And I just say to you, continue in your community. Do what you can, wherever you can. And don't dismiss the significance of individual efforts. But I'll have more to say about that when I come to the end tonight. So I want to thank all of you. And I hope I've left nothing out. Now, some probably would say, I don't think he left anything out when he was talking about all this stuff. But just trust me on this. You've seen the tip of the iceberg. In other words, there's so much on it. And I recognize that we haven't answered all the questions, but I hope that these impressions have been made. That number one, that there are answers. Number two, that we must never be ashamed of our faith in the Word of God. And number three, that we can learn a lot of things, and then we can help others to learn, and we can help each other along the way. So let me launch into this tonight, and let me go back to the very beginning. I put this before you. This text about apologetics, that's what we've been doing. And I'm calling upon you at the end of this to remember the individual and personal responsibility that you have to defend the faith. 1 Peter 3:15, sanctify the Lord God in your hearts and be ready always to give an answer to everyone that asketh you a reason for the hope that's in you with meekness and with fear. It shows you both how to do it, meekness. That means that we're not arrogant about things. But meekness conveys the idea of being under control with an attitude of humility toward God. With meekness and with fear, attitude toward others and reverence for Almighty God. And I'll tell you this, if we don't spend our best efforts in trying to please God, what's it all about anyway? You know, isn't it a waste? And after all, if we're going to go into eternity, then we need to be prepared for that. So involved in that, of course, is thinking about God. And you know, isn't it true that if we spend 5 minutes a day thinking about God and 16 hours a day thinking about all the things that have to do with his life and living it, isn't it reasonable to think that the world around us and physical things are 200 times more real to us than God is? So we got to spend more time thinking about these things soberly and honestly. And thinking about God, God has an intense interest in this planet. He's no absentee landlord. God's concerned about us. It's almost unbelievable when we think that he's so concerned that he knows everything about me. Absolutely everything. And he cares about me. The Bible teaches that. Secondly, God is a being of purpose. In Ephesians 1, 9 through 13, he talks about the eternal purpose of God. God is involved in history. God started this and he's going to bring it to an end. One of these days he's going to come upon the stage of human action and say, drop the curtain and strike the scenery. It's all over with. He is active in human history. And thirdly, God is approachable. The Bible again and again says that we can have a personal relationship with God. And we can call God our Father. And we can have a certain knowledge that he will see us safely through all of our difficulties. Those kind of things will do us good. But I recognize that we live in a world of pressure. There's pressure on every hand, and Jesus taught us that. In John 16:33, he said, in this world you will have tribulation. Pressure is what that Greek word means. Pressure on every hand. But be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. Pressure to conform. Be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and perfect will of God. There is the temptation to give up our values. Philippians 1, 9 and 10, Paul says this, I pray that your love may abound yet more and more in all knowledge and judgment, that you may approve the things that are excellent, that you may be sincere and without offense until the day of Christ. You may be filled with all the fruits of righteousness. So we have pressure upon us to conform and to give up, and to give up the long-term gains for the short-term. We're reminded in the Bible that our Father in heaven knows what our needs are. But we've got to seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness if we're going to make it. Involved in this, we're confronting on every hand modern thought. I want to show you the steps down to despair in modern life. The steps that lead down to despair. The theory of evolution is a part of the thinking of our age. It contributes to the idea that we can talk about a universe without God, and we also can talk about human behavior without absolute values. It's a great contributor to that. And the first step into despair is subjectivism. It's just how you happen to look at it. The religious groups that have said, you know, religion is just how you personally feel about something. That's subjectivism. And the next step down is relativism. Relativism teaches that it doesn't make any difference how you look at it. And then the third step down is agnosticism. Nobody really knows anyway. And we go off into the abyss of despair. When people begin to say there are no absolute standards, what is the truth? Who knows the truth? And in the presence of that, we as a people have got to come back with a biblical response. Such as 2 Corinthians 10, 12 and 18, Paul says, I'm not of those who measuring themselves by themselves are not wise. And then in verse 18, he says, it's not he that commendeth himself, but whom the Lord commendeth. We don't make the yardstick and we don't measure things. Jeremiah 10, 23, O Lord, I know the way of man is not in himself. It's not in man that walketh to direct his steps. In the book of Proverbs, we read, there's a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. This study is important because it can contribute to our understanding that God is in control of the universe, that he has revealed to us in his word what he wants us to be. And that's an important thing for us. How many of you went out and looked at Halley's Comet? You remember when Halley's Comet came? It comes every 75 years. There's a cartoon in the paper. I remember seeing it, and the people were out at night, and one was looking up this direction. I see it. Another was looking up and saying, I see it. Another one was saying, I see it. And they were all looking up saying they could see it. You know something? There were millions of places where Halley's Comet wasn't. If you wanted to see Halley's Comet, you had to look exactly where it was. And in this world, there are millions of places where you'll find none truth. And if you're going to find the truth, you're going to have to look exactly where it is. It was Aristotle who said, truth is finite, but error is infinite. And we people who are meeting here tonight, most of us, I think, are committed to the proposition that in the midst of millions of things that might be called erroneous, there is one place to look for the truth, and that is in the Word of God. And we're committed to that proposition. So tonight, what I'm going to do, in continuing, I'm not going to review everything I've said. I'm going to launch right into discussing the age of the earth issue. Now, we've talked about a number. We've talked about comparative morphology and physiology, the argument the evolutionists make. We've talked about genetics, vestigial organs. We've talked about the fossil record. We've talked about fossil men. We monkeyed around quite a bit last night. Now, we showed you that evolutionists do teach that men came from apes or monkeys. And I'm not going to repeat again. You wouldn't find me saying again that silly thing I said the other night, that evolution is what causes the monkey in the zoo to ask him, "Am I keeper's brother?" I wouldn't repeat that kind of thing. But let's talk about the question of the age of the earth. Now, the age of the earth that's given today by evolutionists is 4.5 to 5 billion years old. Sometimes they postulate that the universe is maybe 10. I saw 20 billion, they cut it in half, made it 10 billion. But now there are evolutionists who hold that, and then on the other hand, there are non-evolutionists. There are people who claim that they're following the Bible, but they accept some sort of a gap theory where they'd like to put in between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, they'd like to put a big gap in there. Or those people who teach what's called the concept of continuous revelation, and we're not going to talk at any length tonight about that. But I want to talk about why the earth is thought to be very old. And we're going to talk about the appearance of age. People say, well, it looks old. And there are kind of things that would demand that it be old, such as the rock formations are coal and oil, and then radioactive dating, which is not a way to get a boyfriend, girls. And then starlight, light coming from the most distant sources in the universe. And then the idea that it's necessary to the concept of evolution, and that it is a very old earth. And even though if you had an earth that's millions or billions of years old, we've showed you by experimentation, observation, you cannot have evidence. You cannot produce evidence that you've changed organisms. We do not have the evidence there, even in the rock record, of these transitional forms. We've discussed that, but we're going to come back now and look here at the age of the earth. Let's talk about the idea of the appearance of age. Now, of course, if you accept the idea that here are these layers of rock, and it just takes hundreds and thousands, even millions of years for those to be laid down by slow, gradual forces, then someone says, look at that, that's got to be very old. But we discussed the idea that the issue is not about the rock formations or about the fossils per se, but the interpretation of those rock formations and fossils. And that if you had very large, huge, tremendous forces working over a short period of time, you could produce the same kind of work. In other words, looking at the rocks themselves is no proof that they're very old. Appearances can be deceiving. Now, an example I set before you was the palustrate fossils. And this is just a simple diagram to show that if you have a tree that's 20 to 30 feet long and it's running through several of these layers, you can't make a very valid or convincing argument that the tree was upright while millions of years went by while these different layers were being laid down. Palustrate fossils are a very strong argument against the concept that it was very slow, gradual forces working over a long period of time. I talked to you about an 80-foot long whale in Lompat, California, and that they found. Now, there again is another example, rather dramatic, of the idea that just looking at these layer of rocks, you see, if you didn't have something like that in them, you say, well, now they were laid down very slowly and gradually. And what I talked about earlier in the week was about the tremendous evidence that we have for catastrophism, or as Jimmy Durante used to say, catastrophes. But catastrophism, the idea that there have been tremendous forces working, not requiring a long period of time in order to accomplish that very thing. But you see, the idea of uniformitarianism is the idea of just saying, well, these things work slowly and gradually over a long period of time, and examples that they would give sometime are stalactites and stalagmites. Have you ever gone into a cave? And that's an interesting experience to go and follow a guide around while he takes you through a cave. He'll come up here and he'll tell you about how old these things are. And one guide that I heard about, he came up and he says, now these are actually 5 million 6 months old. They said, that's pretty accurate. How do you get something that accurate? Well, it's easy. When I came here 6 months ago, they told me that they were 5 million years old. So they're 5 million 6 months years old. Yeah, okay. Now the assumption of how long does it take this material, you know, water filled with minerals to drip, 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 drip. And the point is that we now have some places that we know the age of these places, these structures. We know when they were built. And here's some examples. You see these stalactites that grows from the foundation ceiling beneath the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. And the idea that these would have to take a very long period of time in order to develop is the assumption that you couldn't have something dripping more rapidly than something that just drips, drips, drips. Now, the idea that this stuff happened rather rapidly is found in a bat that is inside a stalagmite at the Carlsbad Cavern. I mean, when it touched it, they were able to cover it up before it deteriorated, and that indicated something was moving kind of rapidly. I'm just saying, when people say, well, you look at the rock formations, you know, they got to be old because they look old. Well, they look old to you because you've been told that they're old, if that is that deep, you see. Another thing that we need to look at is, for instance, this example of Surtsey Island off of Iceland. Very interesting thing that happened. On Surtsey, only a few months have sufficed for a landscape to be created which is so varied and mature that is almost beyond belief. This thing came up out of the ocean, and then it begins to form, and when they would come back a few months later, it would look as if it had been years and even centuries and only been a few months. And what I'm trying to say, if you visited a little bit later, you'd think, man, that thing's been, something's been going on here for a long, long time. And Surtsey Island is proof otherwise. 3 weeks later, you may come back to the same place and be literally confounded by what meets your eye. Now, there are precipitous lava cliffs of considerable height, and below them we'll see boulders worn by the surf, some which are almost round. It says it looks like it's very old, but it's not old. But let's come to the question about coal formation. See, we've been taught over the years that it would take just millions of years for coal to be formed. But what we're talking about here is heat and pressure, folks. And if you get enough heat and you get enough pressure, you can accomplish in a short period of time something that you might, you know, reasonably argue under other circumstances would take a long period of time. And the evidence is coming in. Look at this article here in Chemical Technology. The formation of coal from woody and other cellulosic material in a very short time was demonstrated by experiments performed by Dr. George R. Hill of the College of Mines and Mineral Industries, you see. He says, these observations suggest that in their formation, high-rank coal, anthracite, and low-volatile bituminous were probably subjected to high temperature at some stage in their history. A possible mechanism for formation of these high-rank coals could have been a short-time, rapid heating event. And so the argument that the Earth has got to be very old based on the existence of coal is not any longer valid. Or what about the idea of oil? The idea that oil is the result of something that took a very, very long time to produce. It has been experimentally demonstrated that cellulosic plant-derived material, such as garbage or manure, can be converted into a good grade of petroleum in 20 minutes. Well, if you go into a laboratory, you have enough heat and enough pressure, you can produce oil in 20 minutes. Now, what right are we given to assume that in the past history of this Earth, that we have not had these tremendous events that have a power to heat up and produce pressure that is able to do this? What I'm trying to say is the argument that the Earth must be very old from the idea of appearance is not a compelling, overwhelming argument. But let's look, if we will, at the methods that are used in what we call radioactive dating. There are three major methods there's a lot of methods in one book. One man, Melvin Cook, in his book Prehistory and Earth Models, reviews 40 methods, but three major methods are found in what we call radioactive dating, or arguments from radioactivity. There's a uranium-thorium-lead method, and this gives them figures that are in the billions of years. The potassium-argon, it was famous, you remember when Leakey's
Zinjanthropus was dated by a two-man team from the University of California. That's potassium argon, millions of years. And then you have the famous carbon-14 we're talking about, thousands of years. Now, what is the principle behind the radioactive dating method? Well, we have elements that are unstable elements. And in this case, we talk about uranium, U-238. This is called a parent element. A parent element, and then over here we talk about a daughter element. The idea is this element comes from this element. U-238, which was used in the bomb, uranium U-238, will over a period of time disintegrate by radioactive disintegration and will produce lead, Pb206, and in the process it gives off helium. One of the most interesting things to note about the world in which we're presently living is that we do not have enough helium in the atmosphere to account for 4.5 to 5 billion years old. It just won't work. Now, what I'm trying to say is that we need to look at all this data, but we need to understand how this takes place. What happens is that this disintegrates and produces lead, gives off helium, and oftentimes rock hounds, people who collect rocks, will tell you that you can pick up rocks. They look, when you pick them up, they just look rough and dirty, and they're just ugly. But those who watch for these things carefully know that when they can take and cut through them, they saw through them, and they'll have a beautiful rock which has what's called pleochroic halos. What happens is that there's an inclusion, a radioactive inclusion in the rock, and when it disintegrates, it produces beautiful colors. And what it does, it fractures the rock because it gives off this helium gas and produces a pressure. Now, Robert Gentry, who has worked at the Oak Ridge Atomic Energy Facility for many years, has done a study over many years of these pleochroic halos. And what he says is that the evidence is that the disintegration of the radioactive material has not been a constant thing. We need to talk about this whole idea of a clock, and the clock is based on the idea that this thing just ticks away, you know, in a figurative sense. It disintegrates at a constant rate that is not affected by heat and pressure and so on and so forth. We need to take a look then at this radioactive dating method. Now, when you come up with this idea of time, like 4.5 to 5 billion years old, they talk about what they call the half-life. Now, I'm going to tell you this a little bit about this so you can just evaluate it and then see where we're coming from. What they mean by the half-life is how long does it take half of this to disintegrate? And you can see here, if you, for instance, started at noon, and you see that if you started with 16, by the time 3 p.m., you'd get 8. By 6 p.m., you'd have 4. By 9 p.m., you'd have 2. And midnight, you'd have 1. And this curve of decay is what's called the half-life. Now, let me illustrate it, if I can, what they're doing with it. Suppose you'll allow me this, that you've got a safe over here, and you can put silver dollars in the safe. But allow me this, that once every 24 hours, half of the silver dollars turn into 2 half dollars. Are you with me? And in the second 24 hours, half of the remaining silver dollars turn into half dollars, but half of the half dollars turn into quarters. Now, have I got you sufficiently confused? The question is, if you allow those premises I've set before you, is it possible for you to go in and count the silver dollars and the half dollars and the quarters and tell how long it's been in there? Yeah. If you allow me to give you those premises. Now, what we have when we're talking about these radioactive clocks is what we have to say about any clock. If you have a clock and you tell time to the clock, there's three things that take place. Even my wristwatch or a clock back there, you don't have a clock here, but in any clock, you have to know, in order to tell how much time has transpired, you have to know the initial condition, the final condition, and the rate at which the clock turns. That's obvious, isn't it? It's even if you take a 1 minute or 3 minute timer, you know, and you have to know, you know, at what rate does this clock work? Now, let me give an example of a problem in a clock. I was preaching in a meeting years ago at Noble Hill, Missouri, and it's outside of Springfield. And they were beginning at 8 o'clock at night. And I noticed something strange as I spoke. I felt a little strange. I didn't know what it was, but it had to do with the clock they had back there. Of course, we preachers are said to be afraid of clocks. I don't mind them if they just don't tell me what time it is. But now, One of the brethren came to me and says, Brother Clark, are you going by that clock in the back? I said, well, I guess maybe it was. Well, you can't tell. You can't do that. And you know what that clock did? When it got to the top, let me get it this way. It would go whoop. And then it would go slow up this way. And it kind of justified, it kind of worked it. You see, it didn't turn at a constant rate. I mean, there was something wrong with it. It goes whoop, you know, and then. And I said, well, why don't you get rid of it? He said, it'd divide the church. So, okay. But you couldn't tell time by that clock. Why? Because it doesn't turn at a constant rate. Now, we've got to understand this when we're talking about radioactive materials for talking about the age of the earth. You see, one of the assumptions built into it is that it is a constant thing. It doesn't vary like people say, well, now, how long has this sedimentary action been going on? Well, you measure it. Yeah, but you know, sometimes there's more water than others. Or people count tree rings, right? Or they try to get devices. But you say, oh, in this radioactive dating material, we're going to be able to have an absolute clock because we've got something that is ticking away at a constant rate. Well, I've already suggested to you that Robert Gentry says, no, not necessarily so. There's evidence that the rate at which these radioactive inclusions have disintegrated has varied. And he says that if it has not varied, you can predict the lines in the fracturing, and they're never found that way. Now, over 50 years ago, Oliver Holmes said Arthur Holmes said that if this clock has gone faster in the past or shorter in the, you know, faster or slower in the past, you don't have a clock. In other words, if the rate at which a clock has turned has varied in the past, you don't have a clock. Now, the thing you need to understand about radioactive dating methods is this, that they have assumed some things in all three of these areas. Now, the assumption is in radioactive dating is the initial condition. Now, let's go back to this and look at this. The assumption has been that at the beginning, in other words, when they say the beginning of the earth, you see, radioactive material has led us to conclude that the universe had a beginning. This earth had a beginning. If it had already been here, you know, eternally, you wouldn't have any evidence of this stuff, would you? But the fact that you have evidence of it indicates that it had a beginning. But the point is, do we know what the condition was at the beginning? Do we know that in the original creation there was nothing there except uranium? Now that's a nice assumption, a neat assumption, but we don't know that, folks. We do not know that for certain. All right? Then we're talking about the final condition. The final condition would be, what you do is you measure the amount of uranium and the amount of lead, and you assume that all of the lead came from the uranium. But that's a problem too. Because when you go out here and dig up samples, you have to be sure that there has not been any affecting of the sample. In other words, if something has happened so that leaching takes place in the rocks, so all that you find there is not representative of what really took place. And this is a problem in the potassium-argon method. Because we know that in the potassium-argon method, that our atmospheric argon can intrude a sample. So you see what I'm saying is that there is, in the radioactive dating methods, some very strong assumptions. And the problem is that when you read the books on it, you'll have 280 pages talking about the technology that helps us to calibrate the radioactivity and very little discussion of the basic assumptions. But those who get in it and discuss those assumptions will reveal to you that we just do not know for certain, like frequently it's claimed. Now, for instance, let me use an illustration here. Suppose I took you into a warehouse and I said, I've been experimenting with this candle. And the candle is 8 feet tall. And it's about this big around. And I told you by careful control of the temperature and everything in it that I can tell you that 6 inches of that candle will burn every 24 hours. And I take you in there and I show you this 8-foot candle. And I'll say, now tell me, how long has it been in the warehouse? And can you tell how long it's been in the warehouse? Well, the answer is no. Because you have to know how long it was to start with. And if you don't know how long it was to start with, I don't care how careful your calibrations are, and I don't care how carefully you measure its present length, you cannot tell how long it's been in there. And these are some of the fundamental things that have to do with examining the dating method based upon radioactivity in our present time. Now, To put this in more technical terms, Harold Schlusher, in his Critique of Radiometric Dating, and that's a very helpful book, the criteria for using these geochronometers, what characteristics must a clock have to be a valid indicator of geologic time? One, there must be a change in some physical quantity with time that can be measured in an understandable way. See, this is what I tried to tell you a while ago, but this sounds more technical. Sound a little clearer. The clock must have an accuracy and sensitivity to measure the time intervals in question. Was there an initial amount of physical quantity present when the clock started? The clock has to run at a constant rate. The clock must not have been reset in any way. So what I'm trying to tell you is that when you begin to look at the data, what you discover is that they'll get all kinds of readings that are conflicting and vary with one another. They'll date the same site, and they'll use the uranium, thorium, lead, the potassium, argon method, and they get conflicting readings again and again and again. And so what I'm trying to tell you is that when we come up and have people say that there's an absolute compelling reason for us to believe that the Earth is that old, oh no. Now, as I showed you earlier in this, that what we do when we're discussing the use of evidence or evaluating evidence or discussing creation versus evolution, we show that it's not an issue of the evidence, it's over the interpretation of the evidence. And something very interesting took place in the trial that was conducted in Little Rock over the question of the law in Arkansas, a law which would insist that both evolution and creationism be taught in the public schools. In the course of that, one of the witnesses there, Dr. W. Scott Morrow, a biochemist from Wofford College, said that creationists actually look at more data than evolutionists. He's an agnostic and he's an evolutionist, but what do you mean by that? He says there's a temptation to simply look at the rock formations and assume, on the basis of uniformitarianism, it took all that long period of time for them to be laid down. Then they look at some of the data that's derived from radioactive dating, and so here's what they interpret that. Radiometric dating of rocks and rock formations of the Earth is 4.5 to 5 billion years old. But what must be noted is that creationists, and I think rightly so, insist that we've got to look at more evidence than that. And there's a handout back there on the table where there are 33 examples, 33 instances of evidences that have to do with this area that you need to look at. Evidences that point to a young Earth. Now, I'm not going to be able to go through all of those tonight, but what I'm suggesting is that when you're studying anything, you need to be willing to look at all the evidences. I was telling over in the high school today that when I go to high school sometime, I will ask the teacher, particularly if the teacher's a little belligerent, and these were not today. They were very receptive, and I appreciated very much their attitude, and I think good was done. But I will ask the teacher, did you ever in your undergraduate or your graduate days, or since you've been a teacher, have you either written a paper or assigned a paper on the scientific arguments against the theory of evolution? You get the drift of that. And many times the teachers will say, they'll smile and say, oh no, there aren't any. Well, obviously, if you didn't ever learn any and you come out of the university and you're going to be teaching science and you've never learned any, you're not going to teach any, are you? That's just logical. And so what I would say is, if there are these, why don't we let the students look at them? And that was some of the things I was trying to do today. And so I'm suggesting to you that we look at the radiometric dating and then evaluate it and critique it and show its limitations. And if you want to see that done, look at the prehistoric Earth models by Melvin Cook. Melvin Cook is the world's leading inventor of slurry explosives, and he examines and evaluates 40 different of these methods. And shows you that when you make the necessary adjustments in the figures based upon the presuppositions, you have these dates reduced to thousands of years and not to billions of years. But what I'm suggesting is that if you look at radiometric dating, take the concept of catastrophism, which would have, particularly in the Genesis flood, a force that would be large enough to produce tremendous heat and pressure. If you look at oil well pressures, you cannot have an Earth as old as they claim and have the oil well pressures that we presently have. The helium inventory that we mentioned a while ago, not enough helium in the atmosphere to account for that long a time. Or population kinetics. If you take, there's a formula that you can work out, and these are referred to in that handout, and they're out on the table there, that you cannot possibly, if the Earth is as old as they claim, you cannot possibly have the population figure that you have today. It won't work. Or rapid earth magnetic decay. A study of 125 years was made of the earth's magnetic field by Thomas G. Barnes of the University of Texas at El Paso. And he's a creationist. And his argument is made for a young earth. Polonium halos. This is one of the interesting things. During the Arkansas trial, everybody at the trial, both the creationists and the evolutionists, had to admit that the evidence presented by Dr. Gentry about polonium halos, simply the evolutionists had no response to it. It's one of those oddities, one of those things that they just couldn't deal with. Or the shrinkage of the sun. If you take seriously the shrinkage of the sun, and you talk about the universe being as old as they claim, the sun would have to have been so large, or would have been so large, that we would have been inside of the sun. Now that's just one of many, many things that what I'm saying, we talk about dealing with the age of the earth. I ask you, I plead with you, look at the evidence. Look at the evidence for a young earth. There's considerable evidence. Now then, another thing that is appealed to, and I was showing here on this, radioactive dating, and then starlight. Another argument that's made is based on the concept of light coming from the most distant source. And you take, what is a light year? Well, light travels 186,000 miles per second. You remember Einstein had his famous formula, E equals mc squared. E is a measurement of ergs, m is mass, and c is the speed of light. Now, what happens when you smash atoms, the parts are less in their mass than they were before, and you've changed mass to energy. And the way you compute that is, you take mass and then you take C, which is the speed of light, multiply it by itself. Don't even you start right now. You have enough time to do that. But now, light travels 186,000 miles per second. There's 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour, 24 hours in a day, 365 days in a year. And we're talking about how many light years away are these stellar formations? Now, you see, with all that kind of distance and all that time involved in that, then people say, well, you know that the universe has to be older than thousands of years because look at how much time it would have taken light to travel. You see the argument that's made, and it's repeatedly made, about the starlight and the age of the universe. First of all, distances in space cannot be accurately measured. And they have to use triangulation measurement so that down at the foot of it you got 6 inches and the sides are 20 miles. Just give an example of the problem of measuring by the method of triangulation. But secondly, light may have taken a shortcut through curved space. You see, when you start studying about astronomy and start saying about awful theories in astronomy and black holes, you know, and quasars and all these sort of things out yonder, and it really sounds like Alice in Wonderland, that there are those who believe that the universe is curved space. And the thing about curved space is in what's called a Riemannian universe is that when we talk about distances in light traveling, that you got a different ball game. And according to the Riemannian universe, that view of space, that it would take light to come from the most distant source about 15.9 years. But the idea that when God made this, you know, in the very beginning, that he did not have the power, so that when he brought it to existence, that he could have things there exactly as he wanted. You see, you begin to start trimming the sails or start limiting God. You see, I said earlier that whenever you believe in God, you have no philosophical basis for arguing he could not do the supernatural. Like when Paul stood before Agrippa and said in Acts 26, verse 8, why should it be thought an incredible thing with you that God should raise the dead? If there is a God, you have no philosophical basis of saying that he couldn't raise the dead, that he couldn't perform the miraculous. You see, a lot of the arguments that people make are not arguments made upon data. It's the result of presuppositions. They've just ruled God out. Don't even talk about the thing. But it's also that the speed of light was faster, and this is still a matter being discussed. An Australian named Satterfield has been doing a considerable amount of research on the question of whether or not light traveled faster in the past, and it's been slowing down over the centuries, and the results of that study are yet tentative. And the creation concept. The solution to this would lie in the creation concept, the appearance of age. Obviously, if God began something, and he puts a ball of fire in the sky, for me to assume that it's just been there for a long, long time, and God brings it into existence what was not there before, are kinds of things that have to be seriously considered when someone says, well, now we've just proven that the universe has got to be that old. No, it does not. Now then, when we're talking about why they believe the Earth is very old, the appearance, common sense, rock formation, modern dating methods, none of those are compelling reasons. And with regard to the evidence from solar studies, I want to share with you, this is an interesting statement to me, from John A. Eddy, famous solar astronomer from England. He says, and here's the source of it, it's about time, 4 billion years, geotimes, 1978. John A. Eddy said, there is no evidence based solely on solar observations that the sun is 4.5 to 5 times 10 to the ninth power years old. That's the figure we're talking about. And then he went on and said this. I suspect that we could live with Bishop Usher's value for the age of the earth and the sun. I don't think we have much in the way of observational evidence in astronomy to conflict with that. What I'm trying to say tonight is that what is the overwhelmingly scientific argument or evidence that we have for an earth that's 4.5 to 5 billion years old or a universe that's old? It is not overwhelming. But the tendency for people just to accept and say, well, I guess it must be, has led people to raise questions then about what the Bible says about the age of the earth. So I'm going to deal with what I call the biblical data. And I think we need to be serious about this and spend some time with it. We talk about the days of the Genesis account. The Genesis account is characterized by three things: brevity, simplicity, and dignity. Brevity, in only 457 words in the Hebrew, we're told about the beginning of the entire universe, the beginning of plant and animal life, and the creation of man. The economy of words is amazing, especially when you realize that fairly recently the Department of Agriculture put out a statement saying that the price of cabbage seed had gone up and it took 2,500 words to do it. Now, when you have 457 words, that's amazing. It's brevity. And it's simplicity. Not superficiality, but simplicity. One thing I can say with certainty, that in science, the laws of science are generally stated in very short statements and very simple statements. In other words, the first law of thermodynamics is that matter can neither be created nor destroyed. It can be changed. And the second law of thermodynamics is that there is what? A tendency in all things to run down. In other words, they're simple statements. And whenever the laws of science become more and more complex and they put a front porch and a back porch in this second story on a theory, you know they're just about ready to cash in on that, just, you know, to give it up. So when we read the simple statements of the Bible, that does not mean superficiality. The third thing is dignity. Because the biblical account says that this universe has purpose. It says that we are creatures that are like God. God made us in His image, and therefore, when we do anything, when we show creativity, we're simply reflecting that in us which makes us like God. We show rationality, and we have a sense of morality. That's all because of the dignity of this account. But where did somebody come up with 4004 B.C. as the time of the creation? Well, this appeared in Bibles as a result of a bishop named Usher. And what Usher did is he added up the genealogies in the Bible. So-and-so begat so-and-so. And he added those up. You find those in Genesis 5, Genesis 10. The greatest amount of genealogical material is the first 9 chapters of the first book of Chronicles. And you also have in the New Testament, you have genealogy, 2 of them. One in Luke and one in Matthew. You have extensive genealogies in the book of Ezra. But what he did, he added these up. Heard about a fellow one time that was reading over there in Genesis, so-and-so begat, but he thought it was saying forget, so-and-so forget, so-and-so, so-and-so forget, so-and-so. And he said, that's the forgetfulest bunch of people ever read about. But so-and-so begat so-and-so. Now, the interesting thing is that some people got very precise with this. There was a Bishop Lightfoot, and he claimed that Adam was created on the 24th of October, 4004 B.C. at 9:30 in the morning. You just can't get it any more accurate than that. Now, what do we say about this? What do we say about this? We need to consider how genealogies were kept, We need to consider that generations could be left out, and I shall demonstrate that. And we need to understand that there are very few dates given in the Bible in which two things are given, so that you know a time span. One of the few that is given is 1 Kings 6:1, where it says,